Hello, everyone. Welcome to another Bald Move Prestige film. Today, we're talking about Schindler's List, a 1993 epic historical film depicting the events of the Holocaust, in particular, how one German man conspired to use his wealth to defraud Nazis and save approximately 1,100 individuals from being exterminated by the Nazi regime. It was directed by Steven Spielberg. It's widely thought of as his greatest film, with a screenplay by Steve Zalian, who also wrote the screenplays for Awakening, Gangs in New York, Moneyball, The Irishman, just tons of great stuff. It's based on the novel Schindler's Ark by Thomas Keneally, and scored by John Williams, which, you know, is a great counter to the... John Williams only makes one type of soundtrack type of movie, because you will not find a march or anything heroic in this film. It stars Liam Neeson, a very young babyface, practically unknown Liam Neeson at the time. He'll go on to make Love Actually, starring Rob Roy and Shudder, and the Taken series. He's joined by Ben Kingsley of Gandhi, Sexy Beast, and Shudder Island fame, and Ralph Fiennes, who, of course, plays Lord Voldemort in the Harry Potter films, managing to be only his second most villainous role, a literal snake-faced necromancer. The English Patient, the Grand Budapest Hotel, where he plays a heroic fighter of fascism and Nazis, ironically, and The Menu, which I haven't seen yet. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I watched that like last weekend, I think. I enjoyed it.
Is he real creep in that movie?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
he's
yeah.
really good at playing creeps, but then again, he's also really good at playing the most charming person you can think of. This movie is not the first time I've seen this movie. I saw this movie shortly after it came out in 94. My mother rented it and we watched it together. I'm pretty sure it's me, her, and dad. I know my sister and brother weren't there. And it's one of those things, like, you know, I've often mentioned I was forbidden from watching rated R movies due to my being raised in this very fundamentalist Christian religion. But one of the exceptions was this one, because it had a lot of historical value, and my old religion, Jehovah's Witnesses, very preoccupied with the Holocaust themselves, because they were one of the sects condemned to the death camps as well, alongside the Jewish people, Slavic people, homosexuals, Roma, just tons of people that Germany decided were useless to society and wanted to get rid of in as expedient of a fashion as possible. So I got to see this, and I remember making a pretty big impact. I've never seen it again, because I didn't think I saw the need to, and it came up on our, you know, one of our, you know, did we handpick this ourselves, or was this something selected by the executive producers?
I want to say this is a anniversary.
That's so. Right, because this is the 30th anniversary of its release this year. We're quite a bit out ahead of it, but we wanted to do that. I've been watching and listening to a lot of World War II history, specifically the World War II in Real Time by India Nidell, and there's a companion sequence of that that starts up right around the late 40s, or the late 1940, not in the 40s, late 1940, a companion called The War Against Humanity that delves into you know, the war crimes that were committed each week. And there's some harrowing stuff, a fraction of which is contained in this film. I got a lot of thoughts about how I felt the second time through. Watched this on a very dreary, cold, rainy Monday in Cincinnati in January. Jim, I don't know your personal experience of this movie and what you thought of it. Let me know. Enlighten me.
This is the first time I've seen this movie, but it was hard, even as what I would have been 11, 12 around the time of the release. And even as at that age, it was hard to not have a lot of, I guess, understanding of this movie sort of bleed into your consciousness. It was in the zeitgeist, right? Everybody was talking about Schindler's List and in like hushed tones about how amazing it was, how incredibly emotional the film is, and how it will just devastate you. And so I have a lot of, like, I guess secondhand baggage with this movie, where I've heard people say that over and over again. And I'm going into this movie kind of like half dreading the end of it, because I've heard it's just so devastating. And then I got to the end of this movie, and I had appreciated what it done to then. And I saw the scenes that I think were supposed to be emotionally devastating, and they just didn't quite hit me as emotionally devastating as other things, as like, there are a lot of, I don't know. So I should frame this in like, what was my state of mind? Cause I watched this last night, and I had to watch it very late because I was busy the rest of the day with a lot of other work stuff. And then we watched The Last of Us, and that episode was very emotional. I don't know if I was just all wrung out of emotions by the time I got to this, but this, I was looking at this movie a lot more from like a historical context and seeing the sort of the way that like all of the events sort of conspired against these people to bring about a terrible fate, and just seeing the way in which that all kind of came together. And look, I know this is probably not 100% accurate. It's a historical fiction film for parts of it, I'm sure. But like, I was more impressed by the tale of like subtle nudging of people in directions, the sort of coincidental nature of who survived and who didn't. And by the time I got to the end, I guess I was so wrapped up in those things that I did not quite feel the turn as hard as I expected to, which surprised me because I had heard so much about it.
Yeah, I want to get into that when we get to the spoiler take, because I had a couple, even of seeing this movie 30 years ago, I had a couple misconceptions about how I misremembered the movie and how it went, that I was fascinated watching it as an older man. And I guess I hit it because I think you're right. There's a couple of, you know, I've seen, I think, more gut-wrenching depictions of like the brutality of the Holocaust.
Oh, by
and you can't
far.
Get much more brutal than like seeing some of the, like just the documentary film footage of the mass graves and, you know, the train, and like this
of
is
Auschwitz, of all the concentration camps. Yeah. With people who are just so malnourished as to be skeletons and then being ushered into ovens and shit. I mean, this doesn't hit as hard as looking at one of those real photographs to me.
But I think there's like things I think that uniquely work well, that it's like the implication, right?
Sure, totally.
It's not a brutal scene to see a bunch of singing children being herded onto a truck, right? Uh-huh. You know, it's rustly. It's like it could be a school bus, right? It could be taking them to a refugee thing. But like in the context of it being in a labor camp that we now know as the extermination camp. And the fact that, you know, we are just went through a scene of Jewish people being sorted into people who are fit for work and people are not fit for work. And we know what's going to happen to the people who are not fit with work. And these kids being round up without their parents' knowledge and being, and then they you know, you see these lines of trucks with just loaded with children being driven past their parents who thought that they had escaped something, thought they had escaped death for one more day. There's this great line where a woman, you know, they're all in the train cars and they're worried. And she said something along the lines of like, you know, another minute of life is still life. You know, like you try to cling on, you try to do whatever you can to keep living until you meet the end. But like these parents who had, you know, they were kind of like relieved and smiling that, you know, they were going to get another few minutes. And then they see these trucks with their children running past. And that just was fucking devastating to me. Hmm. And the fact that, like, you're right, this isn't a story about malnourished skeletons who I think kind of can be dehumanized when you see like the liberation scenes and Band of Brothers and whatnot. It doesn't register as real people. These are fit and healthy people who are constantly aware of where they could, you know, and, or not even, it's like, it's also a story of people like trying to keep hope alive. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, well, if we just do the things we're supposed to do,
right,
you know, well, surely we'll be okay. Why would they exterminate their workforce? Like they keep, you know, like that we're making all their shit for them. How could they do, like the fact that there is a lot of denial about that.
It's in some ways just, like it's a tragedy about human adaptability. in a strange way too. Like these are the context through which I'm seeing it all. And so when they go to the emotional well, it doesn't quite hit. It's sad, and I register that sadness, obviously.
Yeah.
But like,
and I think they did a good job of showing like how you could boil a frog in that environment to get the maximum amount of compliance. And it's not to excuse people that like maybe didn't do more or saw, you know, maybe saw where things were going and could have, you know, done more than Mr. Schindler here. But it's also like, I think if that's your first impulse to be, you know, the cast stones is like, my first impulse is like, good God, what would I have done?
If
I was in the position of the average Jewish person in this film, if I was in a position of Oscar Schindler, I can't quite imagine being in the position of what is Ammon Goth? Like I can't quite bend myself to like think of like what the fuck is it like to be in his head? But like, you know, there's scenes like I felt like a real deep empathy for these Jewish people who were elected by their fellow men and women to represent them within this terrible regime, the ironically named Judenrats, this like council. And like they were just like, you know, like all these people with this daily outrages that are coming to them, and they have no power to do anything, but they're just pressure relief valve. And I thought about the Jewish people who volunteered to be the police force, the police, the ghettos, and were, you know, helping to do the rounding up and stuff. And I don't know. I'm sure there's people that do have harsh judgments for those people. There's people that have harsh judgments for this film, I found out. That was something that surprised me in the research is, you know, there's a lot of, it's a small but vocal minority that has, I think, some pretty good points. You probably guess a lot of them. But I thought it was like all the fact that it wasn't a bunch of skeletons who are on the verge of death, that they had, you know, like these people could still see that, like, you know, if we could just survive somehow, if we could just keep enough of our, if we can keep our family intact, maybe we can survive this nightmare. And I felt like that made it a lot more relatable. And as a, you know, I obviously relate to stuff involving kids and family, but all that stuff, just being and just how arbitrary and thoughtless it all was. You know, like trying to think of like what it's like to be caught up in this machinery that's grinding people up. And, you know, you can fight and protest or run and get shot then and there, or you can kind of go along. And also the act of resistance that was still happening, you know, like, you know, the ways you can still resist these things. And is it better to go out in a blaze of glory? Is it better to do the long con that might, you know, bleed more treasure from the Nazi regime and pry a few more lives out of their grasp? It's also a meditation of harm reduction.
Sure.
You know, if like, if you have nothing but bad choices, do you have, I guess, the strength to keep on making the less bad choices until you don't have those choices to make anymore? I thought all this stuff was really moving. And the fact that it was this very restricted streamline, or I don't want to say restricted, very buttoned down Steven Spielberg working in black and white, where I read some making of that he didn't shoot this like a normal thing where you get all your blocking together and you would have a whole bunch of, you know, animatics and storyboards. He got sets and settings and people with script together, and he treated it like this as a documentary that I'm just going to film stuff as I see it. And because of that, you don't get a lot of the art and artifice that you get in other films, but it does feel a lot more real that way, I thought.
Oh yeah, there's a subtlety to this movie, and I think like one of the things I was reading about the creation of this film is that the script that was turned in by the writer initially was shorter, much shorter, like 80 pages shorter. And Spielberg said, no, let's make this longer. Instead of this 115 page thing, give me a 195. And I think that helps, because like part of the reason he wanted that is because Schindler's transition from being a heartless businessman to being somebody who's going to spend his entire fortune saving as many Jews as possible was too abrupt. It was too like storybook, and he wanted something more subtle and less like concrete. And to me, that's where like the movie really shined. I mean, it shines in a lot of different ways, but that's the one I was looking at going, okay, do I feel like this is real? And in a lot of movies, I would say Well, I feel like someone could have this revelation, but it seems far-fetched. Here, it feels very natural. Like, this is a man who has been, has spent his life hoping he can, I forget exactly what he says in the movie, but basically make his mark on history. Mm-hmm. And he inadvertently ends up doing it in a way that he never would have made his mark on history if he were still the man he was at the beginning of this film, right? And I think the way that they subtly push him over that precipice makes a lot more sense in real life than most movies do. So I really appreciate that part. And like you said, with all the questions of just what would you have done in this situation, at every turn in this movie, it's easy to see why the people made the decisions they made, why they felt the ways they felt, why they viewed it as like, well, it can't possibly get worse than this. And then every time you imagine that it can't get worse, it gets worse. Right.
Right.
And in ways that you didn't expect. And I think, yeah, that's probably the best part of the movie for me is those subtleties in it.
Yeah, there's nothing that's lighthearted or comical in this movie. There's no attempts that's the other thing I thought was surprising is that I didn't remember this movie being 3 hours and 15 minutes long. And when I looked up, I was surprised. I'm like, oh, I wonder if this is like a director's cut. No, this is the original release. This movie doesn't, I don't feels like it's 3 hours and 15 minutes long.
No, for sure.
I felt like it moved on a really good clip and was completely absorbing.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I kept on like forced myself, you should make a note here because, you know, there would be like 30, 40 minutes go by where I was just sitting there, you know, kind of spellbound.
Yeah.
Same here. Just either horrified or because that's the other thing. It's like I think the reason this is a really effective film and affecting film is not because it is so tragic and so sad, although it is all that. It's also extremely inspiring,
mm-hmm.
you know, of like, because what is a 1,000 people against 6 million? You know, it's a pittance, right? And the movie certainly feels that, but there's also ways where you can show that, you know, I guess the Jewish faith itself has some. This is something from the Torah that if you save a person who saves one life, saves the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you look at it from that perspective, 1,100 is a hell of a lot. I just thought this depiction of and the way they depicted Schindler, the way they depicted Goth, I thought that stuff was just really, really interesting and really effective. Because, you know, one of the reasons that Steven Spielberg made this movie is because he was kind of incensed in the 90s. I don't remember it like this, but of course, you know, as a sheltered kind of rural kid, there was, I guess, a resurgence of neo-Nazism, Holocaust denial. The stuff was getting aired on the media and taken, you know, seriously as a debate. And Steven Spielberg decided to make this movie kind of like as his way of fighting against that. And it's also interesting that 30 years later, we are also seeing after that a resurgence of anti-Semitism coming from very wealthy, powerful, well-connected individuals. It's being taken seriously like I've never seen it taken seriously in my lifetime. The internet has added a whole other level of like snark and infantilism to the Holocaust denial and that I find personally distasteful. The fact that like the other thing is like knowing that how many of the Schindler Jews, as they're known, were alive back in 93 and knowing that almost with a certainty, none of them are now.
Mm-hmm.
You get this kind of like the other thing is like this foreboding, like turning over of a clock cog that like, oh God, there's an entire generation that were firsthand witnesses of this shit, this runaway fascist ideology, this ideology of annihilation, and they're gone.
Yeah.
And what risk does that put us in a time where no one believes official accounts of anything? You know, this movie, I think, is neat. And I think this movie would surprise a lot of people because I imagine there's a lot of people that haven't in our audience even that hasn't seen this film because of its reputation, because it came out so long ago, because it's black and white, because of its heavy source material, because of the heavy source material. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't know. It's like now more than ever, we need movies like this. And there's this Ken Burns documentary on America and the Holocaust that is on my list of things to see that just came out that I've heard is excellent as well. Because, yeah, I mean, if we're, yeah, it's trite, but if you forget these things, you kind of doom yourself to repeat them, because why wouldn't you? There's such easy and obvious solutions to your problems. What's the other? It's some hidden element in your home country and abroad that's fucking everything up. You could have a great nation if you could just get rid of these types of people, and those types of people might change from time to time, but it was it's a bad time to be a Jewish person in Europe in the middle of the 20th century there, and you don't know who the target will be the next time. But it will be a wrong-headed target that will kill a bunch of people unnecessarily. So I don't know. I think it's good. If you haven't seen this movie, I would certainly encourage you to do so. If nothing else, just to see something that Steven Spielberg created you might not ever have seen. You know, like this doesn't feel like a Steven Spielberg film.
Yeah.
It's the most un-Steven Spielberg film I've almost ever seen.
I agree.
And
with
he
that.
Was. Did you see that he was editing and approving visual effects work for Jurassic Park as he was filming this movie, which he described as a deeply bipolar experience.
I bet
that he would come, you know, he'd rented this Polish television studio's satellite up and down link a week at a time, just to all week long download the video, the visuals and audios of Jurassic Park. Then he would then edit on the weekends. And he said, it's like, oh, with Jurassic Park, it was all I poured all of my craft into. And with Schindler's List, I poured all of my intuition. And it was just a deeply kind of bipolar filming experience, a very depressing one.
I bet.
He said that he wept daily. He actually had his friend Robin Williams call him to give him, like, you know, these, I guess, hilarious, you know, Robin Williams bits to kind of cheer him up, and he'd watch Seinfeld reruns to try to kind of like keep his spirits up. But it was just it was a grueling experience, as you can imagine, for a young Jewish man himself.
Yeah.
Lots more crazy to talk about. What do you have any other any non-spoiler thoughts about this movie?
I don't think so. I want to get into it.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next Pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. And now, back with more Bald Move. Okay, so if you're not familiar with this film, this is about a German businessman named Schindler, and Oscar Schindler, and he is off to Poland in the middle of the war, just after Germany has taken it, and their lightning offensive, to seek his fortune. There's cheap Jewish labor to be had. There is a war that's got a huge appetite for durable goods, and he has spent a time building up black market connections and flattering Nazi officials to be in the catbird seat, to profiteer from all of this. And that's exactly what he does. He starts opening up these factories producing enameled pots and pans for use in the field by the soldiers. And he hires almost exclusively Jewish labor to fill his factories. At some point, he begins, the pains of his conscience begin to prick him as the oppression to Jews goes from, you know, I don't think it was ever subtle or covert when you're in the 1940s, but goes from distasteful to outrageous to indefensible. And he has to decide what, if anything, he can do about it. And that is the 3 hour, 50 minute runtime. Spoilers from here on out. I kind of want to talk about that first part is because I remember thinking that Oscar Schindler is a hero and that he was a wealthy businessman that didn't like Nazis and he decided to use his fame and fortune to save a bunch of Jews.
Wow.
I was very wrong about my memories of this film. And I was kind of shocked at how unsentimental it was in the portraying Oscar's just the naked profiteering side of him.
Huh? Yeah, that's who he is at the beginning. He is a man who does not care about the fate of these people. All he cares about is making money off the war.
And it's not just that. He's just a deeply kind of unserious type of person. He's a womanizer. He cheats on his wife. He schmoozes with Nazis. He is a big drinker, partier. Says very thoughtless things to his Jewish employees to say the quote unquote employees to say the least. And the other thing is like there's not a moment where Schindler sees the light.
Right.
There's a couple of moments you could point to that are, definitely nudge him that direction. But the film, I think, to its credit, doesn't give a lot of overt concern to why Schindler did this, or make him out to be like some kind of outstanding person of moral virtue. He's not like a Jean Valjean from Les Mis, where he's just a good, incorruptible person. Mm-hmm. He's just a regular old greedy person who decides he's seen enough and can't see no more and does something about it. Whatever that is, he does. And I think, I thought that was really weirdly inspiring that you don't have to be a fucking Mother Teresa. You don't have to be Mr. Rogers to make a huge impact on people's lives. But that came as a total shock to me.
And there are a couple of points that I want to talk about in regards to that. A is like it really, I guess, showed what I would call growth on Schindler's part. And demonstrated like how far he's come on a personal journey, whereas maybe some others of his peers have not. When he goes around to his business peers, and says, "Hey, I want to buy basically all these Jews out of slavery, and I want to take them back to my own factory in Czechoslovakia, and we're going to keep them safe." And his peers are like, "Eh, nah, no thanks, dude." They haven't had the same, I guess, relationship with this war in this time as he has. And I think that's part of that subtlety too, or it helps to like underscore the subtlety without like highlighting, hey, this is a big change of heart that he's had. It just shows the contrast, right, between who he was before, which is represented by those peers, and who he is now. I thought that was really good. The one I don't want to call it a flaw in the movie. It's the one thing that like really stands out. It sticks out like a sore thumb in this movie, intentionally so, obviously so. It's the girl in the red coat. Mm-hmm. I don't think I like that. I don't think that belongs in this film. It's the most obvious nudge in a direction that this film gives the character the entire time. And I think it's too much. It's a little bit too much.
Mm. Yeah, it might be. I take it that this is that this account of this girl in the red dress or the red coat was told to Steven Spielberg by people who survived the ghetto. And like it was such a striking thing to him that he decided to. I kind of wrestled with that, too. Like, what does it mean? Why did they show it? There's a two part, it's if it's a moment in Schindler's life, it's a two stage reveal. Like when he notices the girl being rounded up and being terrified during the liquidization of the Polish ghetto here. And then when they exhume all the bodies to hide the war crimes, there's this like all like this realization late in the war that they were going to lose and that, oh shit, a lot of this stuff looks bad. We got to go and try to, like, you know, bleach the crime scenes. But I don't know. It's like one of those things where I think they were trying to visualize just how in, like, this massive humanity, like that, is it a Joseph Stalin quote about, you know, a single death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic. Out of this huge statistic, roughly 6 million people that are going to die in a short span of time, you pick out one face in a crowd of, like, you know, just particularly, like, you know, this girl in this red coat, and that somehow humanizes the entire group, and just, like, the horror and the senselessness of, like, you know, how could this little girl be an enemy of the state? How could the
sure.
I don't know. I agree. I don't. There's a lot of ink spilt in trying to analyze, you know, like, why that thing is there and how it works in the sense of the film. And I think that's fine to say you don't like it. I don't know that I like it or dislike it.
Yeah, it just felt like too much of a nudge, like too obvious of a thing. I was really enjoying the subtlety of it all. And then, boom, they hit you with that hammer. And I'm like, oh, okay.
It feels like it violates the film's internal rules.
Yeah.
You know, that, like, you see the film in color. These men are observing the Sabbath and are saying Sabbath prayers and they're lighting these candles and you have all this warm glow. And then the color drains out of the film. Spielberg explains this. It's like, this is showing that, like, there's still life, but without color. You know, people were living, but there is no life. Mm-hmm. I think is the exact quote he said. And that, you know, then at the end, where Oscar has got enough of his people to, and he's secure enough that he can, like, kick all the Nazi guards out and let the Jews celebrate the Sabbath. And when the rabbis light that candle, only the candle flame itself is lit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the life is starting to return. I don't know what the use of red symbolizes in this ghetto sequence. It seems like it violates that rule for color, but it's also clearly just something that stuck out in Steven Spielberg's mind from these survivor accounts that he wanted to kind of pay tribute in some way.
Yeah, I was trying to find Spielberg's own words about this, and I don't know, when I finally found them, it didn't really ring super true mm-hmm. to me. Although, like, his description of events, I think, is accurate. The symbolism here doesn't make a ton of sense to me. So his idea here in this scene is that it was intended to symbolize how members at the highest levels of government in the United States knew the Holocaust was happening and didn't do anything to stop it. And his exact words, it was as obvious as a little girl wearing a red coat walking down the street, and yet nothing was done to bomb the German rail lines. Nothing was being done to slow down the annihilation of European Jewry. So that was my message in letting that scene be in color.
I saw that.
That is
same
not
thing. You're right.
What I got out of it. What I got out of it is this is the moment that Schindler has decided enough is enough. I can't tolerate this. I have to do something.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I guess
I'm trying to think if it works that way.
Things.
That's Steven Spielberg's way of saying even Schindler, who has been portrayed as this kind of, like, you know, non-serious kind of fuckboy, decides that he can't even see enough. But you've got, mm-hmm. you know, Western generals who are bombing the shit out of German supply lines that are directly contributing to the, and, you know, have a lot of intelligence. You know, they've cracked the Enigma machine. They've done all this stuff. Almost certainly knew about this, but didn't even,
sure.
you know, I thought it's reasonable. Like, why not bomb the rail lines between the capital of Poland and Auschwitz, for example? Why not make the Nazis' lives harder? You know, maybe they would find, because the one thing that impressed me about what I've gotten into this World War II day by day or in real time sequence is how the Nazis had a hard time enforcing their racial purity amongst themselves, like even with their mm-hmm. handpicked SS people lining up a couple thousand people in a trench, men, women and children, and shooting them in wave after wave after wave just fucking erodes the human soul. There's a story mm-hmm. where Goebbels came out to witness it and wept, like fucking Goebbels. So like one of the things like they were desperate to find the solution of like, you know, like, okay, let's rotate men in shifts. Let's do the whole thing where we have multiple marksmen for each person. So there's plausible deniability of who's squeezing the trigger. Let's make sure that all the men that do these things kind of like, you know, fraternize together. So there's a shared kind of guilt. But ultimately, they had to turn to the gas because Germans, and they didn't think they had a reliable source enough of Germans willing to do the shit that they want, that they needed to do to purify the European continent of international Jewry. And that was like, that was the this whole mechanism to make it to where it's like, oh, you just put people in the room and they're dead. And, you know, then you have, you know, other prisoners clean them out and shove them into. This was like a nice, tidy thing to them because that's the way they could like keep their hands clean.
The movie deals with that in a couple of places, right? The ones that stuck out to me were the scenes where you see the guys who were like smuggling shit, selling things on the black market and the streets and stuff. A couple of them join up with the police force there in Krakow. And I was like, okay, I mean, you could see somebody joining up with the police force. Like, it pays better, and like things aren't crazy bad yet, you know? Okay, they've been moved maybe temporarily to another part of the city, and it sucks there, but like, you know, there's no mass executions yet. And you start to see like how you could slowly move people from being, if you immerse them all at once into like mass executions and put a rifle into the friend of someone's hand and said, shoot this person, they wouldn't do it. But if you, you know, kind of slowly move them through those stages, they would potentially. And then the scenes at the end, when Schindler has his factory in Czechoslovakia and he tells the war is going to end, and he tells these guards, oh, look, I know you have orders to execute everybody here. You can either return to your family as murderers and do that, or you can return as men. And they all turn around and walk out, right? Like, none of them wanted to do this stuff. It was simply, you don't have a lot of choice, right? Because there are people who are willing to do this stuff. And if you try and stand in the way, you get steamrolled.
Yeah. And again, all I said that not to excuse, like, I'm not trying to excuse the individual Germans that, you know, went along with this stuff.
No.
I just always try to think, is like, you know, what would I do and think in that situation? Mm-hmm. And the fact, I think it's interesting that even the Nazis had trouble finding people that were Nazi enough to do the shit that they were ordering people to do without psychological. Because like, yes, other thing, in the Wehrmacht, especially in SS, heavy drinking, use of hardcore drugs, amphetamines, it required this to be, it's to be inhuman.
There's that shot. This is probably an iconic shot. Like I said, my first time seeing this, but that shot of the pile of bodies burning and that SS officer just losing his goddamn mind in front of it. And I think that's out of like, in my mind, that is a man who deeply hated these people, and he's kind of the worst. But also, it's a man who's seeing shit that no one should see, and it's not real anymore. Like, reality is gone from this man, and he's just lost his damn mind.
Yeah, how can you conceive of that? I thought there's another shot where they're coming into Auschwitz, and you see the furnace, like the smokestack, it's just burning 24/7. Yeah. It's like flames coming out. It looked particularly hellish. They're like, yeah, there's a unreality to all this, to the extent that like, I thought it was interesting that in the Polish labor camp, in the midpoint of the movie, there's women who, you know, they're up late and they're telling, this one woman's telling the story about, I heard these rumors that, you know, that they're no longer sorting people into, you know, this, that, and the other. It's like, you know, as soon as you arrive, they strip you naked, they shave your head, they give you a bar of soap and tell you to go in this room, and then they gas you. Mm-hmm. And the other women are like, that's bullshit. There's no way that's true. Why the hell would they do that? We're their workforce. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like even at that point, they're sitting there. They've had the scale of theft in this movie. It really drives that home. Like the fact that like whether you were wealthy or not, the Nazis just took everything from you. And the way they also cloaked it is like, at every phase, it's like the Nazis would just lie to you. They're just like, well, okay, we're going to go here and blah, blah, blah. And your bags will be reunited with you. No, they're not. They're going to be taking this mm-hmm. next room and they're going to go through for all your precious metal, all your leather, all that kind of stuff, anything they can reuse. And it's going to be sent and used for the war effort. And then, you know, like, oh, don't carry anything. All your possessions, like all that stuff was. But just the scale of theft that they were pulling off in terms of. You know, you even get a little bit of the Oscar is like, oh, I got this nice big apartment that they put me up in this beautiful city in Poland and all this. It's like, mm-hmm. well, yeah, we just saw the wealthy middle class Jews that were kicked out of it, man. You know,
yeah, it's the scale of everything. It's the machinery of it all. It's just like if this were to happen to one person, you'd say it's a tragedy. What do you even call something on this scale? It's
a Holocaust.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you invent a word for it,
right? There's only one word for it. It's crazy.
Because it might go down as like one of the worst mass murder events of human. Because like before the 20th yeah. century, you could never do it at this scale,
right?
You need mechanized industrial society to efficiently exterminate people in this scale.
Yeah,
like I said, I don't know. Maybe Genghis Khan killed more people in raw numbers, but per capita in terms of like, you know, in an organized, efficient. I don't know. This might be the still the big event. I'm a poor student of history, though. There might have been crazy shit to happen in the Middle Ages. But yeah,
well,
it is industrial.
So I think I know nothing about like the Jewish faith and their customs and ceremonies and stuff. And so when I saw the two candles that were being lit at the beginning and end of this movie, I was interested to go figure out what those were. Apparently, this is a Sabbath ritual. Mm-hmm. You light the two candles to represent, I believe, to remember and... Oh, what is the other word? There's two elements to it. You remember and observe the creation of the world and humans, and also deliverance from Egyptian slavery, essentially.
Mm.
And I wonder, I was thinking, man, okay, those are big events. That's a big event in Jewish history. Is there any call? Was there any call? Would there ever be any call to integrate an event like this into that remembrance and observance? Because this seems... On a scale of 1 to 10 to be a goddamn 10.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that stacks on, because like the one thing I've appreciated about Jewish history as like if you want to like discount biblical accounts of like, you know, being slaves in Egypt,
sure, which sure.
I think there's dubious archaeology evidence for that. But it seems like if you want to say go back into like the last 1,000 years, I don't know that you could find a more persecuted race of people for a long time, for like longstanding reasons, mm-hmm. Longstanding compounding reasons that like, you know, you might get a generation or two of relative peace and prosperity. And then some new guy would take over rule and decide that the problem is the Christ killers. The problem is the, you know, these people that we put in charge of the banks because we are religious customs outlaws from running banks. They're the ones that's ruining society. And like was like this clockwork, you know, there's the pogroms would start this, you know, this violence, this oppression, this, you know, this diaspora that's just kind of like driven onto the four corners of the world to escape this persecution.
Mm-hmm.
And it culminates into this event where they made a fucking earnest effort to just wipe them off the face of the earth. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Events
seems like
make
Jews
it
have a very complicated rituals. Relationship about the Holocaust and, you know, what it means to honor it and what it means to remember it. And I wonder, I don't know. I'd have to ask people. You'd probably get a lot of, you might ask 100 Jews and get 100 different answers about.
Sure.
But it's my understanding that they haven't instituted a new holiday, a new holy day for remembrance on this. It's probably been rolled into all the other historical, you know, religious stuff.
That's what I was thinking. Like, are there ever modern events that sort of, I don't know. When I think of rituals, I can only think of rituals that have existed for ages, right? Forever.
Sure.
There had to be a first Sabbath celebration, a Sabbath commemoration. And I would think something like this would register, but what do I know?
I want to talk before, because we've gotten off of Oscar Schindler, I want to talk about Liam Neeson's performance, because you mentioned that he goes through that as profound internal change, and we're not really privy to it. We see a couple scenes suggesting, you know, him seeing these horrors, and certainly the girl in the red coat is kind of emblematic of that. But you mentioned that, like, there's not a lot of change in his character. They don't talk about it. It's not like there's a scene where him and Ben Kingsley's like, oh, we're now going to conspire to save all the Jewish people, right? That work for us, right? That's what we're going to do now. They don't really do that. And I thought it's interesting as how little Schindler changes. Like, there's a couple points where he flies a little too close to the sun, where like where like he's conspicuously showing kindness to Jewish people. The one that I think he comes the closest to is where he has them have fire hoses to like spray down the cars because it's so hot in there and the people are literally wilting, dying, can't have of thirst, and he's having people spray fire. You know, like, this is an act of kindness, spraying people with fire hoses through barred windows on a train car. But you can tell, like, the Nazis are kind of like at first thinking, ah, fuck it, whatever, who cares? But then it's like, why is this guy so animated about watering these Jewish people? Doesn't, and also kind of like, what an idiot, doesn't he know? Does it, like, what this is, like, literally, this is a story about a man in hell in the Bible where he asks for someone to get, you know, give him a drop of water at the end of his finger to cool his tongue. It's that kind of thing where it's like, these people are already, they have no future. It's been declared by policy. They mentioned in a movie at one point that these people have no future and he's still trying to save them. But like, outwardly, he's the same guy. He's still glad handing the Nazis. He's still going to Ammon Goth and, oh, beautiful day today, isn't it? He doesn't show the contempt that he has to feel towards these guys because he knows he has to, you know, just like he never felt the flattering adulation for these people when he was buttering them up. That skill he used to kind of like, you know, keep what he was thinking behind his eyes and just keep the wine flowing and the women flowing and the caviar and all this stuff. He's whining and dining these fools. He maintained that till the end. And even like, he had a very astute, it seems from this film, way of using the Nazis' worship of process and business and production above all else against them. Where time and time again, he'd, you know, be like, I need these people because they're the only ones that know how to work this machine. And, you know, we need these people. Like, do you want to make these pots and pans? Or the thing that I thought was really fucking grim is where, you know, he had bartered for these 1,100 people that he thought he'd save. And at the last minute, you know, he had to go to Auschwitz, the fucking jaws of hell itself, to get a train full of people that got misrouted. And the Nazis going to let him go reluctantly, but he decides to keep all the children because what possible use could they have in a war effort? And Schindler grabs this little girl's, Jesus Christ, this little girl's hands, and he holds her. His hands is like, look at these fingers. How else do you think I can polish the inside of a 45 shell casing? He's probably making shit up. But he's like, how else am I supposed to do it? You tell me. Not like any appeal to these people's humanity or their better nature or as fathers or as sons of mothers or anything. Just like, I need these little fingers to help the war effort.
And he uses their own cruelty against them in certain scenes, right? Like, there's a train scene where he's looking for Stern, who's been loaded onto a train mistakenly as a non-essential worker or whatever. And he goes up to these kind of underlings and says, well, I can guarantee if you don't give me this guy, you're going to be on the Eastern Front by tomorrow morning, right? By next week. And they know that's true. Like, if they make a mistake here, they're headed out to where they're certainly going to die or where they're going to be just subject to all sorts of horrors. So, yeah, he's using their own cruelty against them in those scenes. I almost think some of these scenes make Goth, I don't know how to say his name, look kind of like an imbecile. I can't even quite put my finger on it, because he realizes in that train hosing down scene, he realizes that Schindler is not doing this as a joke by the end of it. This is not some, you know, ruse to make the Jews look pathetic and stupid. He's genuinely trying to help these people, and he does nothing about it. He does not in any way change his behavior toward Schindler. And I don't understand why.
I think, and I could be wrong, because I've really only seen this movie once with a critical eye, but I think it's because Ammon Goth, I think that he is mistaking Schindler for having this kind of Jewish fever that he has, like that he has found, he's in love with this Jewish woman that he abuses, and he has this kind of like fixation and hatred in, and he, like, the way I saw that performance is him awakening, kind of like, God, what a sad son of a bitch this guy's let himself. Look how, like, essentially pussy whipped he is. That's what I thought.
But
because they
God
have that
has it for one individual, for an individual, and.
Well, that's what it said. Like, what if I, so, oh my God, what if I, I kind of like, it's like there, but for the grace of God in a perverse way is like, go I, like, what if I became so enamored this where I started letting her talk me into saving her favorite rabbi or doing this or that.
I would think
other.
This would inspire some kind of backlash though, from him. I would think it would inspire him to fight even harder against that impulse and take it out on Schindler.
But I think so, like the other thing I was shocked to find out is because I didn't think this was based on a really true story. Like it might have been like elements or like there might have been like that Schindler was a composite figure of a bunch of different German businessmen that kind of did similar things. Kind of like we saw in Valkyrie where there's like a guy that did this and that, but there's a lot of composites because that, you know, this is like three different assassination attempts rolled into one. Mm. But no, apparently this is a 100% true account. And again, it's probably been. It's got to be dramatized, you know, right. That's exactly what it is, a dramatization of these events. But these are essentially pretty true events. And there was 1,100 people that were very highly motivated to make sure that people didn't forget what one Oskar Schindler did. Mm-hmm. And that he was very popular he's very popular with Jewish people, probably down to this day. They mentioned this at the end of the film that he was invited. He was declared by a Jewish council righteous amongst the nations, which is like a special recognition that Jewish people make for people that have served the Jewish community as a non-Jew. He got that in 1963, planted an olive tree along this path of righteousness. And he is the only Nazi party official to ever be buried at Mount Zion in Jerusalem, which is an extremely high honor. And that's at the end of the movie, you see, that's another thing I found moving. You see the real life people escorted by the actors that played them by the real Oskar Schindler's grave as they put a pebble or a stone on the grave in remembrance. And by the end of it, there's hundreds of there. This was a real story of what a real guy did. And it did bankrupt him. He was destitute for the rest of his life. In fact, he survived mostly on cash contributions from the Schindler Jews. A lot of them went on obviously to have children, make things of themselves. When he was in financial trouble, they tried to help him, and then he eventually got into poor health and died of liver failure. Before this movie was made. But where were we going with that? The whole... I remember I was surprised that it was as based on reality as it was.
Yeah, I was talking about why there wasn't more reprisal from...
Yes. So this is a real story. And you don't get a lot of the Gott side of it. But like towards the end of the war, Gott himself was getting to be under intense scrutiny because he was making this immense fortune running all this black market scams and stuff with Schindler, and that he like was in no position to be pointing fingers and whatnot at this. In fact, I think he was dismissed out of the service before the war was over and put in a mental institution for.
Yeah. I saw the end tells you that, right? When he's being hanged, there's a little caption there that says, he was arrested and put into an asylum.
So I think it's like the movie doesn't explain this because it doesn't explain a lot of things, but I think the real life explanation is that he was just about to run out of his own runway for doing stuff.
I wish the movie had made that more clear, because to me it stuck out as a moment where he did wise up to what Schindler was doing, and he should have punished him, but he didn't, and it was kind of out of character. because the movie hadn't made that point.
Yeah, and I wonder how they could have put that scene in there, because like
you don't know,
he might have wanted to, but like it wouldn't be prudent to point the finger at Schindler, because there'd be at least five fingers pointing back at him, or four fingers
maybe
pointing back at him.
I don't know, maybe if he had like tried, maybe if there was a conversation between them that said, oh yeah, well I'll tell them about Helena if you try anything here. I don't know, that seems too movie like.
The movie made explicit that's probably the last day that Gott and Schindler ever saw each other, because he had saved all the people he's going to save from camp that
Gott
had
overseen.
Then
he goes and he buys all of the Jews who were in that camp from Gott, and then takes them to Czechoslovakia.
Oh, you're right. That's slightly before.
Yeah, there's a whole other sequence with him interacting with Schindler. So.
Well, also Schindler had been in trouble. He got arrested three separate times. They only showed the one, but he got arrested three separate times for suspicion of, you know, violating the Nazi rules on race mixing and racial purity and all that. And because I guess he had absurdly high connections in the beginning of the war. Number one, he served as a spy, some kind of intelligence officer in the lead up to World War II that, like, I guess helped the German war effort out a lot, and that he was very skilled at like just glad handing and sucking up to people, making sure that he was, they showed that early on, like he was very keen to get picked, you know, have these big lavish parties that Nazi officers would attend. And then they have no idea who this guy is, but by the end of the night, they're laughing and slapping him back, and he's getting pictures of all of it and putting it in his, he had all these powerful friends that, like, anytime someone would be like, this Schindler guy looks like, what the fuck? We know. And another weakness of the Nazi party is that, like, once you got, it's wild, because like they were extremely paranoid and they're always turning on each other. That's one thing about the Nazi command. But they also had this absurd kind of like, once you prove their loyalty to them, and or a personal loyalty to someone who was personally loyal to somebody else, that you were essentially, you couldn't be touched. Mm-hmm. Because if you did say or do something to the wrong person, you could find yourself off to some godforsaken front where you're like to die. Mm. So,
you know, maybe there is a reprisal. I'm remembering the order of scenes here. And immediately after that train scene, Schindler's arrested for kissing that Jewish girl during his birthday party, right?
It's the least of the things that he did to piss off the Nazis in this film.
Right. It's some violation of a Race and Resettlement Act is what they call it.
Right.
And I thought, okay, this is Ammon getting realizing that he's sympathetic to the Jews and punishing him for it. But then Ammon's right there arguing for his release. He's the guy spearheading that, and I don't know if this is a power play, if this is to show Schindler, if you cross me, this is what I can do to you, and if I were not there to get you out of this situation, you'd be in even hotter water. Maybe that's what it is. If so, it's very subtle, and I am only now putting it together, but I don't know. I'd have to see it again, and I don't expect to watch this again anytime soon.
Yeah, it's not an entertaining film. It's a very good film, but it's not an entertaining film.
It's not.
That's the other thing
movie.
They found, you know, in Nazism Doesn't Work headlines. I thought the one part that almost is funny in this film is where Gott takes his pistol out in sheer pique to try to murder somebody who he doesn't even have. That's the thing. It's like he's half time he's murdering people he doesn't even have great reasons for. He's murdering this guy for, you know, even though he could time, this guy can make a hinge in 30 seconds, he'd only made like 17 hinges that day. And the guy's trying to explain to him that their machines were taken down for calibration for all morning. So he was putting on a sweeping detail or fucking plowing snow, whatever the Nazis would have the Jews do from any given day to day. And he's like, as this guy is stumbling out this apology, like he's just racking around shooting, and there's just dud after dud after dud. You know, part of the refrain you get from the Holocaust denial crowd is like, well, why didn't the Jews do more to save themselves? Why didn't they do more to resist? Ignoring, and you, it's like to be a Holocaust denier, you have to be willfully ignorant of history. You have to walk past the hundreds of experts and the reams of testimony the detailed accounts the Nazis themselves kept of how many people they killed, and cherry picked one or two dumb fucks, you know, that also don't understand history, or maybe have a methodological problem, or maybe you're misquoting to get this. But like, the reality is the Jews did a lot. The Jews were involved in resistance. The Jews that even when they're forced to do this labor at the pain of death would do everything they can to sabotage the efforts. One of the reasons the Nazis had terrible reliability problems with equipment in the field, because like, oops, a whole bag of sand got poured into this steel batch. Looks like it's only got one tenth of the tensile strength it should have. Well, turns out everyone, the bullets in this factory just going to misfire because they're crimped. They're the shit's pulled out.
Like, there's all kind of like, was that sabotage?
And then they make it explicit, because there's no fucking way a whole clip of ammo is going to misfire. You know, and then they make it explicit at the end. I guess this is the second part of a third Seth Martin reveal where, you know, him and Ben Kingsley are making jokes about how they want to make sure that no functional shell ever makes it out of this munitions factory.
Yeah.
You know, even if we have to buy shells from the black market at exorbitant prices to pass to keep it going for as long as we can, we don't want to make any parts that are going to go, you know. I thought that was and how clever they must have felt. Like, oh, we're going to extract the maximum value from these people, and then it's they're slitting their own throat because you're using the labor of people that fucking hate you and want to do whatever they can to stop you. And
you can't, you know, you don't have enough forces to look over every single shoulder.
No. No. And it's not a thought. I mean, again, it's not a thoughtful ideology. That's one thing in my studies of fascism and Nazis is this, you know, there's a lot of anytime you start studying World War II, there's always these like apologists is like, gosh, if the Nazis let up on the crazy break just a little bit, you know, if they only picked like a couple of people to hate at a time, but they couldn't help themselves because they're fucking following a crazy ideology.
Yeah.
You're acting like it's like Hitler had his little hand on the throttle of like crazy German paranoia. And it's just like finally no, that shit was at full crazy pants from the time they did whatever they thought they could get away with. That was the only thing that stopped them. Like international or sometimes sentiment at home, because that's the other thing. How many death camps do you think were in actual Germany? Of all the concentrations, the famous ones, Dachau, Auschwitz.
I want to say it's probably like 5 to 10. There weren't tons of them, right?
Zero.
What
there
do you
were
mean?
Zero concentration camps in Germany because the Germans themselves wouldn't fucking Germany, yeah. Right. They had them in the occupied territories and Poland and Czechoslovakia and places
like
that.
Sorry, I thought you just meant in total.
So, okay. But until just like a year or two ago, I assumed that like if, you know, if there was like 12 great death camps, at least half of them had to be in Germany proper, right?
Sure, but
no, they exported all that shit because a lot of German, you know, there's the one thing that halted the infanticide going on in Germany where they're rounding up and killing every like mentally ill person or physically infirm person is like an outpouring of outrage by the German clergy and German doctors. Like, what the fuck is this shit? You know, they had to stop this extermination of the undesirable because like, again, they had to keep this far from home and as far from the front lines as possible because this is they knew at some level this was bad press, if nothing else.
Yeah. And also, can you imagine if these people, you know, who ran these camps went home to their families each night? Like, what does that look like? You know, they probably wanted them out as far away from anybody who could tell them what they're doing is insane. As possible. There's one scene that we kind of touched on earlier that I wanted to talk about in this context.
But can I, before we move on, okay, it's the same context. Okay, never
mind. It is, yeah, where they're, one of the women in one of these camps is relating the story about the showers, right? Where they cut your hair, they strip you down, they put you in the shower and just gas you. And the people who are saying, well, that story can't be true because we're their workforce, you know, they wouldn't kill their workforce. That would be stupid. They think they're dealing with a rational intelligence based military here. What they're dealing with is a hatred movement. It's entirely different. They don't care that you are their workforce. They only care that you die because they hate you.
Right.
And it's just that scene Like that's one of the saddest scenes, is when this person just doesn't realize what they're dealing with here.
Yeah. And that's the sad, that's the other grim thing about these fascist ideologies, is like, if the Germans were successful in eliminating the Jews from Europe, guess what? Nazi Germany would be a deeply problematic, flawed society that had real systemic issues, that because it turns out the Jews weren't the ones sabotaging your whole nation from within and without. Mm-hmm. So then what do you do?
Go on to the next group.
Do you actually go about fixing the problems, or do you identify enough? Mm-hmm. And like the early goings of the Nazi Party were that, like, on speed, where it's like, you know, the Nazi Party, we used to be a big, you know, a big tent. You'd have Jews in the Nazi Party. You could have homosexuals in the Nazi Party. You could have all that stuff. And then, like, as they got their grips in power and they started making that undesirable group bigger and bigger, yeah, they will never get to the bottom of their problems, because they would always find an external threat to attack rather than actually try to fix the problem. You know, yeah, that Germans, because, you know, again, after World War I, Germany had all kinds of fucking problems. Mm-hmm. Economic, demographic, all kinds of things that needed real solutions. It wasn't rounding up all the Jews and gay people and physically infirm and eradicating them, obviously. I was going to mention that, like, you know, there's a no small amount of just good old fashioned brainwashing that went on to get the Germans into the state too, like SS people that joined the SS organization. They were forbidden for celebrating Christmas. They had to do the pagan solstice, because Himmler was, like, really, and Hitler too, is kind of obsessed with, like, getting back to the original Aryan roots, the fabric, the bedrock fabric of the people that defeated Rome, you know? And they couldn't, they wouldn't have Christian marriages. They would have these weird SS, civil bonding ceremonies. So they, like, you know, how do you go home and explain this to your wife? Your wife and kids are deeply invested in what you're doing, mm-hmm. and they have been brainwashed into the cult too. You have, these are all Christian people who have been brainwashed and transformed by the Nazi Party ideology for their purity. So a lot of times there probably were.
Yeah.
Like, that's right. One of the more bracing scenes in the film where, in the very early goings, where the Jews are being forced into the ghetto, and regardless of their economic standing, and they're, like, you know, taking everything they can carry into the ghetto, and there's these lines of Polish children screaming at them, buy Jew. Mm-hmm. Like, can you imagine what it'd be like in your neighborhood, yeah, in your city, to be turned out of your home for whatever reason? Let's say you're a fan of the team of the city next door, or you are you're a Protestant instead of a Catholic, whatever, and the children in your neighborhood are taunting you and throwing literal shit at you as this is happening.
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad for the children and I hate the parents. Like, that's what I feel in that situation.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Thank you.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
What did you think of the scene where Schindler convinced Gott that the true test of greatness is how many people that you spare? It's not how many people you kill, it's how many people you pardon.
I think it's a
and
really
that
good scene.
Actually, it had a momentary impact on Gott, where he was like kind of feeling it and like, but so what ended that experiment? And I just wanted to say what you thought of that whole sequence.
Yeah, I think that sequence is great. It's just the way that Schindler is able to kind of pull a little judo on his mind, because, you know, clearly he respects Gott respects Schindler quite a bit. They're kind of early going in that movie, very similar. Gott is envious of his wealth, of Schindler's wealth, of his influence with women, of his very charismatic nature, all the things that he has, Gott wants. And so when when Schindler tells him, like, your true power is having the power and choosing not to wield it, he tries it on the next day. Gott does. And I think it's another interesting instance of Schindler saving lives, but without his money. You know, he later in the movie, he's going to say, like, look at this car that could have been 10 more people I could have saved. Look at this pen. I could have saved another person with this stupid pen. But indirectly, he was saving a lot of people in other ways too. And this is a good scene that represents that, because there are two people that he definitely saved, at least temporarily. We don't get to see their ultimate fate, I don't think, before Gott realizes what's happening in his own mind and says, no, I'm not going to entertain this. This man is not telling me truths, or just simply is unable to resist and turns back to his nature and kills Leshik, I think is his name.
Yeah, for not scrubbing his tub correctly.
Right. But he saved the two people before, who would have probably been executed for minor mistakes, minor crimes in Gott's mind. But, like, yeah, I thought it was an excellent scene, excellent sequence.
That is also bookended with that, you know, Schindler convincing him that you need to pardon people. That's the true source of power. And, you know, again, just flattering him, gassing him up to get what you want, is booking into that "you almost talked me into it" scene that he has with his servant.
Yeah, Helena.
His housekeeper. Helena, yeah. Yep. Hirsch. That was interesting because, like, because it's in the one scene, Schindler's doing all the talking. He's being very persuasive. Yeah. And he's arguing. And then the book in the scene where it's like there's this brief period where Gott tried not to be, he tried to be a Nazi death camp commander, but make it nice. And right. he gets to the end of that where he's down and he's with his housekeeper and he is trying to talk himself into raping her, I think. Mm-hmm. And he is having this imagined argument with him, her, while she stands there mute, terrified. And he, you know, acknowledges that she makes good points. It's like, you know, you don't look like vermin. You don't look like you have a rat's eyes. You don't look like you have this. And then he almost like he cups her breasts and then he says, you almost talked me into it. I think that's also talking to Schindler. Like that's you're supposed to see that's one, like he had these different two influences in his life. Mm-hmm. That almost turned him to doing, again, I don't know what kind of harm reduction you can do as if you're a death camp commander. Imagine a lot. Yeah. But like he just isn't going to do it because he was committed. Like I think it's interesting. I don't know if this is a true detail, but like this, the last words in the film, certainly the last words out of this bag of shit were Heil Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Like he was, and I read a little bit on his, you know, I guess his real life person, his biography. He's a deeply committed Nazi, died when he was 37. Like he joined SS in 1930s, you know, before Hitler even rose to power. So he was like a deeply committed and I guess ideological into this racial business too. Like he bought it hook, line, and sinker, really believed in it.
And the movie portrays him as full on psychopath. I mean, he is not a man who is caught up in a system that is irrational and evil. He is a representative of the evil in that system.
I think it's like he's either one of the very few or maybe the singular instance of he was executed for war crimes, but also he was convicted of murder, just straight up murder, because there's so many eyewitness accounts of him just like. For, you know, it's, you know, one thing to be carrying out rules, you know, like, oh, you got to gas these people here. So you're gassing these people here. But because it's the law or whatever, you know, it didn't get you out of the hangman's noose. But like, you know, whatever. But like just killing people out of fits of pique and for manufactured imagined reasons.
Yeah, he would just walk into a crowd of people and just shoot 25 of them in the head for no reason.
Yeah.
Someone's walking past him, minding their own business, and boom, they're dead. He is a full-on psychopath. And I think he stands in contrast to some of the other party members in this film, where they are just, you know, they're living through a crazy time and they're following orders. And look, that's not an excuse for their actions, but it is different in its nature than what Gott is doing.
Yeah, a lot of this is the other thing I found surprising. A lot of the people who were filmed in this, I don't know if I should say a lot, but a surprising number to me of the people who were involved in this filming were Jews who survived the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
There was a few that I cannot remember the name now. Some of it's the Friedermans or something like that. There's this one lady, she said the first time she saw Ralph Fiennes in his full Nazi regalia, it reminded her so much of the real Ammon Gott that she had a full on panic attack.
Mm-hmm.
There was a woman who went through the Auschwitz camp system and was in the filming scene of where the women think they're going to be gassed and it turns out not. And like what a traumatic experience that was for her. You talk about Steven Spielberg weeping every day. A lot of people were fucking re-traumatized and traumatized and victimized again, making this film with the hopes that it would help people remember and to never forget this. So, you know, the whole point of never forgetting is so it never happens again. And I just thought like detail after detail of like people who went through these camps, went through and how many people like turned down options to work on this because they were just too close to material.
Yeah.
Or thought they couldn't do a good enough job, or like Spielberg tried to get Martin Scorsese as a last ditch kind of effort, and he's like, "Look, man, you got to a Jew has to shoot this film. There's no fucking way I'm going to come in here." And even Spielberg, like, originally optioned this rights in his 30s, and he waited 10 years until, you know, and again, tried to pass this off to Kubrick. There's a couple other people he tried to get to make this film.
Yeah.
And he said, I just can't because I'm not mature enough. I'm not ready. And finally, in his mid-40s, he thought he had everything kind of lined up together and did this and Jurassic Park as a package deal because no one wanted to bankroll this money. Because they all thought this movie would be a flop, a failure. Nobody would want to see it. And it would just be this passion. But it's like, well, if you're going to make a little bit of money with some dinosaurs, Steven. So there was this like a package deal where you got Jurassic Park and Schindler's List.
Yeah, they bought the rights to this film like 10 years before it was made, which is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Maybe we need a moment of inappropriate levity here because I found a couple of things kind of funny in the movie.
Okay.
Unintentionally.
Other than got click, click, clicking on that poor door hinge maker, I didn't find much funny.
Yeah, but there's that joke that one of the Jews in the ghetto tells early on that it starts as a joke and you think, oh, there's going to be a punchline here. And then the punchline is just, it doesn't exist, right? It's I forget the exact wording of the joke, but you realize halfway through or by the middle of the punchline, oh, this isn't going to be funny. This is grim. Mm. But no, there's so the scenes at the end where Schindler has taken all the Jews to his factory and the war is ending. And he requests 3 minutes of silence to remember the people who they've lost along the way. And then this fucker just starts singing, just stands up in the middle of the crowd during the 3 minutes of quote unquote silence and starts singing. Look, I know this is probably some ritual or custom or something, but don't call it silence if you're going to have somebody singing. 3 minutes of 3 minutes of remembrance. How about that? And then you start singing. The word silence there threw me. The other one is, and I think this is a really beautiful moment at the end of this film, but when the next day, after the war is over, the Jews all wake up outside of the factory and they're like, where do we go now? And I think it's one of the Soviet soldiers rides up and tells them, hey, there's a town over there. And so they show the shot of all of the Jews walking over the hill. And I'm just imagining them going into town, being hungry and saying, yeah, I'd like a table for 1,100, please. Like this town, this small town in the middle of nowhere is not equipped to serve 1,100 extra people during lunch. It's just it's not going to happen. But the beautiful part about it is this is them going to a new place to flourish again, right? They make the point earlier on how I think it's when they came to Poland, they first came there as refugees, essentially, and went to this city and just started flourishing there in Krakow.
Like 600 years ago when they were going through another, they were being persecuted, they were being blamed for the Black Plague.
Okay.
Of course, it's got to be the Jews that did it.
And this is Ray Fiennes telling this story in your first introduction to him. And it's a horrible point that he's making because he's saying we're going to erase the history of the Jews from the planet is what he's saying.
This is an inspiring story that these people have gone through of all this grit and determination, but like we are going to erase all that.
Now it's
this
a rumor.
Where it ends.
Now it never happened. Yeah, he's not just wanting to erase these people. He's wanting to erase any remains of like their existence. But it was beautiful to see them walking to a new place to flourish yet again, right?
Yeah, I think the point there, because there's a couple of criticisms of this movie that I would say are in good faith. There's a couple, like I noticed the amusement, there's a lot of neo-Nazi groups that tried to boycott and organize, you know, because it went a little too soft on the Jews and a little too hard on the Nazis.
Middle East countries, is that possible? Some other Muslim. Nazis. Get out of here.
Yeah, no, there's some distasteful geopolitics that went into that stuff. But there's a couple of, I think, what I would say good faith criticisms of this movie. One of them is the end is some people see it as like a big, you know, it's a whole thing with Zionism, right? That like there is the Jewish people that have a right to be a place where they are secure and safe and are free from being hunted and hounded throughout the ends of the earth. There's also the state of Israel, which, depending on your point of view, has a checkered relationship with human rights within their own border. And it's a whole fucking complex state of affairs. To hear my whole thoughts on it, watch all of The Expanse. Because that's what that's all I'll say about that. But a lot of people took, you know, the Red Army soldier writing up to these refugees and saying, you're free now. And the Jews are like, OK, now where do we go? He's like, well, I wouldn't go east if I were you because they hate you there.
Mm-hmm.
I really wouldn't go west either. Like the idea that like this, the other thing is like the Nazi Germany was not an aberration. Like all of Europe and a lot of North America was swept up in this anti-Semitism in the early the 20th century because, you know, right or wrong, communism was seen as intellectual Jewish exercise that had seen as destabilizing most of the Europe continent and wrecking all the royal institutions that used to maintain order and threatening the new industrial capitalism was coming on the scene. So there's a whole bunch of reasons. So it's like there's no, where should the Jews go? It's an open question, this movie. And I guess the music that they play was seen as like a de facto national anthem for Israel during their win in the Six-Day War over different Arab coalition countries. And a lot of people are like, this is an you have this beautiful movie and then you kind of had this ugliness again, depending on how you feel about it, with the Zionism at the end. The other one is, of course, you just got the white savior. You know, you got Oscar Schindler, this Nazi who has the temerity to grow a conscience and make it about the 1,100 people that he saved rather than the multi-thousands hundreds of thousands of Jews that through their own cleverness and resourcefulness and resistance saved themselves to elevate, you know, almost. You have the feeling that like this Nazi, these two Nazis, Schindler and Gott, are like these larger than life heroes that are fighting over the souls and lives of these people that are kind of like passively going along with all this. And then the third criticism is kind of like what echoes what some of your the thing that didn't sit right with you, the fact that like it feels a little almost like whitewashed, the Holocaust. Like this is the Holocaust light. You don't get the emaciated skeletons. You don't get the true brutality. It makes it seem like, boy, this God guy, boy, if you had a better prison commander, maybe you wouldn't have had the crazy shit. You know, it's like that there's a little bit of, you know, but I like I said, I don't think I agree with any of those criticisms, but I do think they come from a place of validity. They come from a place of genuine concern about how the thing is seen as respectful. And I think there's also like there's a fourth one that's kind of like just should you make something that has any entertainment value about this at all? You know, like is like should it just be
documentaries?
Yeah, like professors in front of chalkboards with numbers and figures. And I think in a sane world, you'd have both because you cannot engage the head unless you engage the heart. But
I think you have to feel devastated by this. And that's the thing that surprised me about watching this movie is I didn't feel the devastation as hard as I felt it just looking at photographs of the time period. Maybe the documentaries I've seen on it have, I don't know, traumatized me more than this film ever could because it's sensationalized and because it's, I mean, that was Kubrick's criticism, I guess, of this film is he said it was ultimately more about his exact words, according to Wikipedia, the Holocaust is about 6 million people who get killed. Schindler's List is about 600 who don't. And he found that I would say mildly offensive.
That's kind of in the second criticism.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think I agree with that because it didn't quite hit me because it wasn't about the people who experienced the most pain. It was about the person who almost incidentally saved a bunch of them.
Yeah. And there is like, you know, again, that goes back to the white savior complex. The fact that like it centers on his pain at the end. It's like, you know, I think this is moving where it's like he's thinking like, oh, my God, I could have saved.
Sure.
If I knew exactly how long we had and how I could think of all the money I wasted doing this and that could have been this life and that life and the Jews collectively embrace and forgive him, essentially.
Right. But that, but, you know, that engages some, my head more than my heart. That to me is like a trigger to say, look at all the people who didn't do anything like Schindler did, right? Yeah. And all the money they had, the vast wealth, the vast resources they could have brought to bear on this disgusting problem, and yet they stood on the sidelines. I see it as a historical fascination brought to my attention by this film, not the heart-rending thing that I kind of expected of this.
Well, the thing is like I've seen lots of brutal Holocaust material, you know, again, just documentaries and whatnot. But like I've saw some things that I've never seen in this movie before. Like I thought it was an amazing detail that they built this labor camp to extract the most value from a Jew before they killed them on a Jewish graveyard.
Oh, just yeah. Already paving the street with gravestones. So it's like, oh, my God.
You know, it's like I grew up and I remember like it's a big thing in the poltergeist. Like, you know, you can't get much more disrespectful than moving people's gravestones and using that for something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the way you could do that more disrespectfully is to build a camp that's going to enslave and kill them on top of it. And then you pave the streets of that camp with fucking gravestones.
Yeah.
I kept on, you see like the work crews of invariably Jewish people being forced to like uproot these stones and lay them down, and like mm-hmm. what a dehumanizing task it must be to brick by brick, grave by grave, demolish your own culture and your own people, be forced to this again because you get another day of life and who knows what will happen tomorrow.
Yeah,
and those
there
people
are moments,
that kept making
for sure.
those pet bets are the ones that survived. That was the other criticism, is that like the way this thing ended with all, you know, like Ben Kingsley says, you know, you didn't just save 1,100 people, you saved generations.
Uh-huh.
And they made that point because you know, a lot of these people that were that survived this went on to have other children, and they mentioned how many, you know, the fact that the families of the Schindler Jews number 6,000, which is still at the time of the making this movie more than the number of Jews that still lived in Poland, mm-hmm. because they just were so successfully eradicating them and displacing them, that like it gave the idea of like these people survived and they were okay. This was like a momentary, and then they went on with their lives, which is belies the years of like some people never recovered in terms of like, you know, they might have gone on living, but there is also a lot of suicide. There was a lot of drug and alcohol use. There's a lot of just like mm-hmm. people that were profoundly fucked up over those experiences, as you'd imagine. So like that was another criticism, is that you got the idea that like these people were saved, like a capital S.
Yeah, I think the final scene does a little bit to assuage that for me, with them putting the real people who survived these events, putting the stones on Schindler's grave.
Yeah,
I think that brings it back around a little bit, but I could see that criticism. Sure.
Yeah, that's the thing. I always try to like, again, try to at least empathize and understand where the criticism is coming from, because most of it wasn't like this is a wrong out of project. It's more like I would have done it this way, or I would have emphasized this or that. I think Steven Spielberg did an extraordinary job of mm-hmm. being sensitive.
Yeah.
For example, he secured the rights to film inside Auschwitz, which is never granted. Never fucking granted. Like documentary crews don't get that, but they're going to open up the gates, and like Steven Spielberg, because there had already been some groups are kind of like, are we going to film a fucking, even if it's about the hot, we're going to film a fucking movie here for like people going to pay money to be entertained. Mm-hmm. And so what Steven Spielberg did is he used the gates of Auschwitz, but he used it through like a funhouse mirror. So like outside the gates, he built a replica of the camp so the filming would take place off Auschwitz grounds. Mm-hmm. To find this way to like, you know, because he had a lot of people helping with this project. He's, I think, a sensitive man of Jewish descent himself, trying to like get around like what are ways that people will take this the wrong way? What are ways that we can bend over backwards to show respect for these characters? And so like I do think it has survived the test of time. It's got 98% of Rotten Tomatoes. But it's always mm-hmm. interesting to see where those 2% like I'm not saying that it would be a better movie if all these things were taken into account, but maybe there should be more movies that do represent, you know, like Jewish actions themselves that saved Jews, that maybe, you know, do show more of the harrowing things that happened, that maybe are less focused on two German-born Nazi party officials, high-ranking Nazi party officials that kind of like, you know, did these big actions to a passive group of people. I think those are definitely things that Hollywood would do well to take and learn from if we want to repeat this experiment every 30 years until the end of time, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. I still think it's a very well-made movie. I think it's a great movie. It's just, I expected... I had expectations that I feel were unfair to the movie because I haven't seen this, but I've heard it talked about for 30 years. Right.
Do you think we are doomed to repeat shit like this? Not, of course, exactly like this, but do we think we're doomed to repeat this as people die and forget? Like, that's the thing that I was struck. All these survivors of the Holocaust that were still, you know, hale and hearty. They're in the late 60s, 70s. You know, some of the children were, you know, even middle age, still having kids of their own. And now you realize 30 years from now, almost none of that, even the youngest has to be dead, or that if there's any left, there's just a handful. And 30 years hence, they will completely be gone.
Yeah. So this was one of the most affecting scenes or even lines maybe in the entire movie when it comes from a modern perspective, is when they are sorting people into essential and non-essential workers, and there's one person who Stern helps to get the essential worker card even though he shouldn't based on their criteria, and what the guy says when he gets denied an essential worker pass is, I'm a professor of history and literature, since when is that not essential? And that to me stuck out as, if you forget the lessons of history, you're doomed to repeat them. It was, I don't know, that was one of the more emotionally affecting scenes for me in the entire movie. And it was so early on, and it's so not the scenes I think you're supposed to feel deeply. But man, when you look around right now, you worry that we are forgetting lessons.
Yeah. And it's wild because, like, any kind of conspiratorial thinking, Holocaust denial, certainly conspiratorial thinking, it's so hard to stamp out, because a denier can give you 100 facts, sentence facts, that all require paragraphs, if not pages, of historians that debunk. Like, oh, this gas chamber had wood doors, doesn't sound like a very effective gas chamber to me. Or like, oh, these walls weren't blue enough if they were exposed to the Zyklon B. Or, you know, can you really incinerate 6 million people if you had 4 years? And there's all this, like, where it's like, well, if you want to give it a serious answer, you have to take time and give it a serious answer. Meanwhile, as you've debated, as you debunk the wooden door theory, the denier has gone on to spout 10 new facts. It's like if you've ever tried to argue with a friend about fucking the World Trade Center, you start off with the jet fuel can't melt steel beams, and like you move on from that, and it's like, well, building seven, like there's because you can always find something that makes you go, huh. But like, you, and unless you're willing to look at the 99% of the data that like supports it, and again, and I think this is another thing that the movie makes brilliant, is the paperwork. The Nazis were above all else German. Yeah. So they fucking wrote everything down and scheduled it all out with tables and spreadsheets. They spent a lot of money with IBM to calculate this shit. There's reams. Like, there's so many different ways to estimate how many people died in the Holocaust. Number one, Nazi records. Number two, the excess death. You know, some of the ways that we can tell how many people COVID killed in the last few years, like about how many people that should be alive and aren't. The fact that there's still to this day only 4,000 Jews that live in Poland. Like, you have to like overlook that stuff. So it's like, I think it's somewhat important to have people around. It's like, look at this fucking arm. I have a tattoo where I was like a numbered like cattle for extermination. If you're in hardcore denialism, you're past like responding to any kind of facts, logic, or reason. So I guess movies like this, I feel like, are good vaccines that, you know, if you can show people this and, you know, it's much harder for a conspiracy person to sway someone who's actually been and it doesn't even take that much education on the topic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's much harder for them to get that foothold, that mental foothold, than it is if person hasn't thought about this stuff at all. So I think these movies play a really valuable part, and I hope people don't stop watching them and making them, because that's when, you know,
well, I think
you do run the risk of forgetting.
Yeah, they absolutely have a place in the sort of inoculation against these ideas. I mean, you inspiring people to better better peoplehood, better human nature is something that movies can do that I don't think documentaries do. I don't think you're ever inspired by a documentary so much as a film.
Yeah.
So they have a very valuable place and a part to play in our historical remembrance of these events. So, yeah, I wouldn't want to say you shouldn't make movies about the Holocaust. I think it's important to. It's just, yeah, what kind of movies are you going to make about it?
And Schindler makes a really good protagonist for, you know, he's not a good conventional one, because it does seem like he is kind of like at a base level somewhat a shitty person. But like, I think it is kind of inspiring that a person who's a card carrying member of the Nazi Party, who has made millions and millions of dollars off the backs of this inhuman process, can still find it at the end of the day within them to do good, to engage in this kind of harm reduction, to try to make to try to save as many people as you can. It's never too late, you know.
And I do like the scene where he's saying, you know, this car could have been 10 more people saved. I don't know. In some weird way, it like puts a price on human life, which I think is weird. But in another way, it puts a price on wealth in human currency, right? In lives. It can be an inspiration to people who have vast resources about what to do with those things. Do you want to just stick it in a bank for the sake of having more? Or do you want to actually go out there and make people's lives better with it?
And this guy, like, you know, it's basic kind of like almost biblical morality that this guy spent all of his treasure that he had amassed to save as many people as he could. And because he did that, he didn't have a lavish lifestyle the rest of his life, but he lived for the rest of his life, him and his wife both, because the people that he saved sustained him.
Yeah.
So I don't know, where do you put your time and treasure? And I do think it's a little bit more inspiring. It's like, you know, Fred Rogers fights the Nazis and saves 1,100 people by tricking the Nazis. Okay, well, yeah, Mr. Rogers did it. But like, if some kind of womanizing skirt chasing non-serious, you know, playboy can have a moment of clarity where it's like, this is just deeply fucked up and I'm gonna have to reverse pump all this stuff, then anybody can, including you and me.
I think the scary implication there is that it takes something like the Holocaust to shock people out of complacency.
Yeah.
That's the scary part to me, is how bad does it have to get before people who are otherwise not inclined to step up and do something.
Yeah, there's a lot of uncomfortable questions about World War II. And it's like, well, what if Hitler had only stayed in the borders of Germany? What if he had you know, and like stopped and sued for peace? Like, you know, what if? But fortunately, we don't know. We don't live in that counterfactual. But I'll stand by that. Yeah, like if Oscar Schindler can find it in himself to revert, like, as deep as he was and as complicit as he was in every sense of the word, if he can do that and win, you know, the gratitude of the sincere gratitude of the people that he saved, again, 1,000 people, it's not nothing, then anybody can do it. And that he showed a certain amount of bravery and courage, because was putting not just his money, it was very much his neck on the line. When he did these things too, because that's the other thing, when he was doing that speech about I could have done more, I could have done more, I could have done this, I could have done that, what you could have done more. And then I think even Kingsley made this point, like when he's talking about, like, we don't ever want to make a bomb that works in his factory, Kingsley's like, well, what if we get shut down and we're all sent to Auschwitz? Like, if you, there's that harm reduction, if you push too hard, you know, if Oscar Schindler's got a fucking Tommy gun and just went to the next SS ball and shot every SS officer there, would it have ended the war earlier, or would it just condemn these 1,100 people to death?
Yeah. I don't know.
I guess lots to think about with this movie. But I was amazed at how much I'd forgotten and how kind of bass ackwards I got the basic kind of like moral story, you know, watching this at 15 versus watching it as a 46 going on 47 year old. And again, if you haven't watched it lately, it's not a bad thing to do, because we've got, it seems like anti-Semitism is kind of popular again, and the way Spielberg was talking about it in the early 90s. So yeah. And refresh your memory why these things are bad. All right, that'll do it for this week's discussion of Schindler's List. We'll be back next week with another black and white film. This one from the contemporaneous silver screen era. We're going to be looking at Citizen Kane, widely hailed as one of the first of the so-called modern movies, seen as very influential.
A lot of people
just
say
saw
the best
it over
film
the winter break.
Ever made? A lot of people would argue this is the best
that.
Film I'm, ever made.
I'm really curious to see what you make of it.
Me too. I've never seen it.
I just watched this like 3 weeks ago. It was over Christmas break. And I kind of want to go back and watch Mank too, which is okay. The fictionalized account of the writing of this story, mm-hmm. starring Gary Oldman and a few other people. But yeah, I'm really curious to see what you make of that. But we'll be back with Citizen Kane. Again, our patron executive producers help us with the Bald Move Prestige movie each week. We submit them a suite of three films that we could talk about, and they select it for us. If you'd like to get on that process, please go to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can join the club and get that, as well as many other premium features such as ad-free feeds, bonus audio content, live video recording shows, etc. Support.baldmove.com. We'll see you next week.